The following pod contains spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
Experiences by Kay is the Bay Area luxury picnic business that can be set up just about anywhere, from the beach, park, your backyard, and more. Simply go to the website, book your picnic, show up, and enjoy a good time with your friends, worry-free. Great for birthdays, anniversaries, proposals, you name it. Go to experiencesbyk.com right now for your upcoming occasion. And check out Experiences by K on Instagram. That's Experiences by K.
Hey, Alan, can I tell you a little secret?
I love secrets.
And this stays just between you and me. No one else in the world is going to know this, right?
Not even our listeners.
Yeah. Okay, so I've been going through Instagram, and I'm not really excited at some of the content that I see. You know, I feel like some of the Asian content that I see doesn't really speak to me.
You know, I hear that a lot, but let me tell you something. There's a solution for you. It's called the Universal Asian.
Universal Asian? Tell me more.
Yeah, you know, they have a lot of great articles about Asian culture, prose, poetry, and I'll tell you what, they have really beautiful photos.
Does this place have a community? Because I love poetry. Friends that know me, I'm a huge poet, and oftentimes they don't know it.
Yeah, Raymond, that's actually a really good point. They have a lot of written articles, poetry, prose, photos, art, and video of a variety of topics. And the best part about it, nothing is off limits. You could talk about anything on there.
Wow, really? So I can like just share my whole story and I can read other people's story on there?
Absolutely. There's a huge community. Just join the Universal Asian community today and you can have access to all these amazing content of fabulous artists, writers, authors, everything.
This sounds amazing. What's the website called?
It's called theuniversalasian.com.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, this is Daniel Lee. As a Hmong American actor, representation is very important to me. I think entertainment and media has a pivotal role to play in shaping the public's perception. We get to be three-dimensional, flawed human beings instead of the exoticized caricatures that history has painted us to be.
Yeah, Daniel, that was awesome.
Wow, thank you so much, Daniel, for being able to say that. I mean, I'm as a Hmong American person in the entertainment industry as well. I'm in the video game industry side. I completely hear you about how being able to be a three-dimensional character matters. Representation matters. So thank you so much, Daniel.
Yeah, definitely. Daniel, thank you for that message. And welcome, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Real Asian Podcast. I'm Raymond Liu, and I'm here joined by Renee, and we have a returning champion, Cindy. What's up, Cindy? How you doing? Welcome back.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Cindy. So happy
yes.
to have you. Girl power.
I think this is the first episode that where there's, you know, female representation.
I know. Finally, right?
Exactly. Women coming to the table.
That's what I'm talking about. Cindy, you are 2 for 2 in Thai Ma films. So I think you're...
I know. You're I think every future Thai Ma film, I'm going to have to come back and make some sort of comment.
This is the second movie. This is the third movie that our rap listeners are listening to where we have done a review. This is going to be my second. This is Cindy's second as well. So that's pretty funny.
I think, Cindy, you're going to be our resident Thai Ma connoisseur for our show. So anytime we need to talk about Thai Ma, we'll just phone call you in. Be like, oh, what does Cindy think about it?
Oh, boy. Better be prepared.
We are here today talking about The Farewell. And I'm so excited to talk about it because it's definitely one of my favorite movies. But before we go into my take on it, let's start with the ladies and we'll go through a quick roundtable 2-minute take. Cindy, we'll start off with you being our returning guest. What were your general thoughts about watching this movie when the first time you watched it and also the second time you watched it through?
Yeah, so I like the film a lot. I think for me, you know, it came out around the time when there were a number of other Asian American films coming out in America. And for me, this was the one that really resonated more with me, particularly when thinking about the way they depicted Billy's relationships with her own parents and then with her grandma and other extended family members and some of the many different types of emotions that they all go through, the tensions, the happiness that they have seeing each other. So I liked it because I felt like it reflected a lot of what I have experienced. I think in particular, the scenes that I really enjoyed, I like the small scenes with interactions between Billy and her grandma. So I think there's one where her grandma's doing exercises in the garden and kind of... I've been doing that around my apartment now just to scare Alan.
Yeah. Wake him up in the morning.
Just like, you know, silly things, or, you know, before the wedding, you know, the grandma telling her, like, don't be shy, like, make sure you, mm-hmm. you greet everyone really loudly. I've definitely had conversations with my parents or my extended family where they tell me something similar, despite the fact that I'm almost 30 to greet everyone I see.
Yeah.
So I think those scenes were just super heartwarming to me. And I think the dilemma that they presented in the movie was also very interesting, because it's, you know, we'll talk, it sounds like we'll talk a little bit about this later, but the whole theme of individualism versus collectivism, you know, what's important to those in the East versus the West. The film also explores that tension, which I think I've experienced and I've seen other folks navigate as well.
There's so much to unpack about the film itself. Before I give my take, I want to have a quick round of asking my question. Did you cry from the movie?
I've mentioned this before. I don't physically cry, but I felt like I wanted to cry. I don't know if that makes sense.
What does that mean?
I'm on the hunt to get Ray to cry, basically. I'm just trying to find as many movies that are just like gut punching. I'm like, okay, got to figure out how to make Ray cry. But all right, so Ray didn't cry. How about you, Cindy? Wait, what are you going to say, Ray?
I was going to say I surgically removed my tear ducts.
We'll add in some eye drops for you. I cried the first time I watched it at the end when the grandma's waving goodbye. I think the second time, more recently, expected it. So I think it was more just paying attention to the details of the film. But I remember the first time, especially when they're driving away and she kind of like starts running a little bit and starts to break down more. That was very gut-wrenching for me because, you know, I have a set of grandparents that live in Asia that I don't see too often. So I felt that a little bit in terms of how hard it is to leave someone who was so happy to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was growing up, I lived with my grandparents in Michigan for a year. And that bond that I had with them when I was 5 years old kind of transcended, you know, the relationship of just grandparent and granddaughter. Like I felt like I was born from them, you know, and so this movie was definitely a very gut-wrenching thing because I don't live near them. So my take on how I felt about The Farewell was that I think Lulu Wang did a really amazing job of transforming this this lie into something that really opened my eyes from how we in America kind of go along with the idea of you know, putting our own burdens on our shoulders versus being able to weather that burden across our community. And even though being Asian, there is still that aspect of, you know, collective burden. I really had no idea that that was something that is a very common practice. And so growing into the movie, I actually had zero expectations. I've watched the movie so many times since. As soon as it hit streaming, I watched it like 4 or 5 times in a row. And each time there's something that I pick that, you know, resonates with me that does make me cry. When the first time through, it was just the relationship and how it bloomed, and how, you know, one of the things that, you know, Nainai says at the very end is, why would I lie to you? Mm. And that, you can see that rift like really cuts through Billy as she's leaving, you know. And so there's all this elaborate lie, right? It's just like one small lie of let's not tell Nainai to, let's go ahead and build this huge wedding based off of it so we can go ahead and see her. Like, it was just like all these kind of lies kind of just kept on building up.
Snowballing.
Right. But, you know, but part of it is like my favorite quote, and I'm sure we'll go through what's our favorite quotes or favorite parts of the movie in a little bit. But my favorite quote definitely is when, you know, Haibin, her uncle, goes and says, you think one's life belongs to oneself, but that's the difference between the East and West. In the East, a person's life is part of a whole. And that really hit real hard.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like that was the pinnacle moment of the movie. And it happened kind of like in the middle of it. And that really kind of encapsulates the entirety of how I personally feel about, you know, that shouldered burden.
Yeah, well, we'll go into our favorite thing about the scene. But generally, you know, The Farewell is one of my favorite movies of all time. Getting the opportunity to watch it again, I was so excited about it. But first time watching it, it was very deeply emotional. The acting is phenomenal. Major props to Awkwafina,
yes,
aka Nora Lum, for nailing this dramatic role. Really, the entire cast is great. Tai Ma, Diana Lin, and of course, Xu Zhenzhao, the grandma, Nai Nai. I seriously felt like I was watching my own grandma on TV. Mm-hmm. I was just like, that is my grandma. That she's just in this movie right now. And the story is so moving. It really puts the audience into this kind of strange predicament of wanting Billy and her family to cherish every moment with Nai Nai, all while kind of holding on to this painful emotional burden. And it's so painful, but yet deferent in a way that the secret is kept within the family to spare spoiling the final days of her living. What I really noticed about my second watch through is that I was processing everything that was happening in the plot, kind of like how I felt right along with the family. There were multiple times where I felt, gosh, why they really should tell her. But then I'm seeing how happy Nai Nai and Billy is with their interactions and their talking and how everyone's happy to have to be together. I'm thinking, okay, shit, maybe they shouldn't tell her. Maybe I was like, let's not ruin this moment right now. And so I can imagine Billy's character kind of going through the same process, the same emotional feelings. Just overall, beautifully written and incredible writing by Lulu Wang. So The Farewell touches upon many themes and cultural values of kind of what happens when you have two philosophies that collide with each other. One of them is, we touched upon it right now, this idea of kind of withholding the truth, especially when it's kind of tragic news, as a form of protection. Cindy, we see this tension between Billy and her parents kind of like right in the onset of this movie, of Billy kind of asking, like, why don't we tell Nai Nai the truth? Her parents explain to her, well, maintaining that telling the truth would only make things worse. Talk about some of the logic behind this philosophies and this like collision of philosophies between the East and the West.
Yeah, I think for those that are, you know, in a parental or kind of like a caretaker role, and especially those who, you know, are in the Eastern culture, it almost comes as second nature to constantly think about how you can best shoulder the burden and protect others whenever possible. And I think in this situation, you can see Billy's parents, you know, when they first have that interaction and she finds out about what's going on with Nai Nai and she wants to go back, but they say, oh, you know, like it's going to be too expensive. Like we've already bought our tickets. It's almost as if they don't want to burden her, not just with the truth of what's happening with her grandma, but also the logistics of, you know, actually traveling to China and like having to go and have that experience. And it's almost as if they're making that decision and trade-off for her in terms of, you know, having that experience, Ray, as you mentioned, of having those moments with her grandma, but also it being really sad because they know the truth and they know that they can't tell her. The other thing I was going to say, too, is actually related a lot with some of these interactions, because I have seen this a similar tension in some of my own interactions with my parents. And it's been a growing process in terms of helping them navigate it and helping them understand that, you know, I'm an adult now. And part of, you know, having a relationship as an adult with your parents is that they start to become more comfortable with letting you into some of the vulnerabilities and burdens that they're holding on to, so that you can also be there to support them. Because it goes both ways, as you can, as we also see in the movie too, right? Where it's, you know, Nai Nai has taken care of us for so long, and now it's our turn to take care of her.
You know, I think it's interesting how Lulu directs this, because you can definitely see like there's a passage of time where Billy is trying to process what should she do. And I don't necessarily think she's actually wondering if she's going to go. I think she's really just trying to come to terms with it, right? Mm-hmm. She knows her parents are saying, look at you. You can't hide your emotions. Yeah. She'll know immediately once you walk in through that door. And she's beside herself in that she knows she has to. It opens with, you see that Billy is someone who is late on rent, who probably doesn't have a lot of money, who probably maybe spends her money recklessly. Someone who is ambitious and applied for, what is it, a Guggenheim Fellowship, but didn't get it, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, she's a smart person, but also at the same time, she has a lot of things that happen to her that just kind of mount up of all these failures. I think she sees this opportunity as a way of coming back home,
yeah,
of being able to take back some of part of her life, which is, everyone keeps telling me I can't see Nai-Nai. I'm going to see her.
I love the scene where Billy shows up in China and everyone in the family is like, oh shit.
Yes. Like,
when I first saw that, I looked at Tai Ma because he displayed the most surprise because he got out of his chair and he was oh, fuck, what the hell? Everyone was like, oh shit. I thought that was hilarious.
As much as the movie was super emotional, it was also really comedic. I think it was really good.
Yeah.
Of course, they didn't make it go over the top, yes, but you know, the ability to make it so that it was something that felt real.
Yeah.
You know, Lulu was saying the reason why she hired Awkwafina was when she was watching her audition tape. There was one moment where she pauses. And she's, Norlim, Awkwafina, she admits she was actually just kind of thinking about like the next thing she was going to do. But that emotion in her face as she was doing it, that's when Lulu said, I want her. So, yeah, you know, I think that was, I agree with you. And the everyone had to bring like high caliber acting to be able to execute this film very well. So it was a really amazing cast. Yeah. And yes, Saima is, he's got that telltale. You just look at him, you know what the scene is supposed to be like. So yeah, it's great.
Renee, what are some of your favorite scene or thing about this movie that just stuck out to you? It's something that you just can't stop watching over and over again.
Well, definitely my favorite thing is that you can tell that Awkwafina doesn't, or Billy, you can tell that Billy can't really speak Mandarin. And so she's very awkwardly kind of going through the motions of everything. Some of the things that she sets up. And it's kind of like, is the reason why when she first gets into China, she's very quiet is because she's not confident in her Chinese. I think so. But, you know, one of the things that she does say is, it was with her uncle as they're going back to the hotel, you know, Wujidou, right? I know. Yes. And so you just, the building around Billy's character about how she is trying to traverse both being Eastern, because she actually is stuck in this third culture, right? This 1.5 generation, because she moved to the United States when she was 6 years old, you can be able to kind of see this rift in her heart of, I still feel Chinese even though I'm American, right? And so those were some of my favorite scenes whenever she was trying to acclimate into China and Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. But my absolute favorite scene of all of that is encompassing is when she has her breakout moment and she's on the ground and they're all trying to find Eichel's earring. You know, Billy's on the ground and she turns around and she looks at her mom.
You know, one of the few good memories of my childhood were those summers at Nai Nai's. They had that garden. Yeah, and I would catch dragonflies. And then we just moved to the States. Everything was different. Everyone was gone. It was just the three of us.
And it was hard. It was hard for us too.
I wanted to believe that that it was a good thing. But all I saw was fear in your eyes. And I was confused and scared constantly because you never told me what was going on. And then Yeah Yeah died.
And so, you know, that scene was so emotionally charged, but it was that really poured in everything about like how I was feeling, how I've gone through. The movie is highly relatable, not just to Asian Americans, but it definitely made us feel seen. And so, you know, I really appreciated that moment and the entirety of this really amazing film.
Another thing I really liked from the movie was the way Lulu really captured the ups and downs, like the happy and sad moments. And as mm-hmm. Renee mentioned earlier, kind of juxtaposing some of the sad moments in between the comedic ones. And also the way they had, I think it was Caro Mio Bien, Ben? Mm. I might be butchering that, but it's this really elegant sounding opera song that they play at different points throughout the movie. And it also culminates in at the wedding. There is a singer that sings the song as well, but you know, it's an opera song about pain and sorrow after you're losing someone, but it also feels, you know, elegant, almost over the top, like could be a celebration of some sort of happiness or joy in terms of what you had experienced with that person. So I feel like it really accurately captured kind of the ups and downs that one experiences in a situation like what, you know, Awkwafina and the rest of her family were going through.
Can I just say how breaking down and crying in during his wedding? Like, how many times have we gone to a family wedding and the bride or groom or the uncle are absolutely just broken down in tears, probably from drinking too much, right? So I thought that was pretty funny.
Both of you guys talked about it. I think the cultural nods in this movie is just everywhere. The nagging mom when you go and visit, right? The playful spanking of the butt when Nine-Eye sees Billy. Yes. The passive aggressive comparison of your kids right in front of your kids.
Oh, damn.
Your uncle repeating the same message over and over again after you've acknowledged, like, okay, I got it. Like, he's like
yes, repeating exactly. Himself.
The nosy ass hotel staff who just like ask way too many questions. You're like, okay, bye bye. Trying to shove him out the door. And then like, you know, Nai commenting on Billy's like physical appearance, like she's like, you're not too skinny. So just the cultural nods, is just a plethora of them in this movie, which really felt like authentic. And I think Lulu mentioned it before when she was writing this film, she just like, it's a personal story for me. And this is stuff that I lived through. And all she wanted to do was just to tell the very nuanced story. And I think she hit it out the park. I want to talk about one of the big quotes and the key lines in this movie that kind of sets everything off and kind of talk about the logic behind it. Chinese people have a saying, when people get cancer, they die, but it's not the cancer that actually kills them. It's the fear. And so there's this idea that if you open your mind or your life up to the fear and the death and tragedy of news such as cancer, you're really kind of double dipping in terms of tragedy, because now you've got the physical element, but now you're like mentally and emotionally ailment as well. And that, I think, is the difference between Eastern and Western philosophy.
I'm transporting myself, you know, back to the very first time that I'm watching the film. When her mom says that, it absolutely just crushed me, because it's true. When some people just end up giving up completely.
Yes.
They're like, you know, they're resigned themselves. They're like, this is it. This is my life. And, you know, I don't know if that really does actually happen. But in regards to the, you know, cultures and communities, you know, how much of that is because we're not really allowed to be our own individuals.
Right.
When we're, you know, when we're in familial kind of communities versus, you know, like selfishness or something like that. I'm not entirely sure. But basically, when I heard that, it basically is the linchpin of the entirety of the reasoning behind why. As the viewer, as an American viewer, Billy's going through, that's what the whole movie's about, is going through that, well, is it illegal? Is it good? Is it bad? You know, is it harmful? And when a little Nai-Nai says, well, Nai-Nai did this too. She did this to her husband. And she picked the right time to tell him. You know, that's when, you know, Billy has to kind of reconcile, well, we're doing the same thing that Nai-Nai did, you know? And so it was just kind of like, you know, right. it continues eating at you. What am I supposed to do? Yeah, exactly. What am I supposed to feel? Right. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me, what my reaction to this quote and kind of to this ongoing discussion about the lie and what it means, my first reaction is always, you know, when you say it's not the cancer that kills them, it's the fear. My reaction is, well, that's my decision to decide if it's if it's going right. to be the fear or not, regardless. And I think what Renee talked about, you know, when you're part of this community, a large part of it is about this unsaid, almost social contract that you have that, you know, you did it for your partner. And now, and because of that, implicitly, you also believe that this is something that you would want for yourself. And so for me, because I feel like I resonate more with the Western ideals of wanting that agency and ability to decide for myself, even if I will have that fear and maybe wish that someone would have shouldered the burden for me. The other thing that I thought about in this quote about, you know, comparing cancer to cancer and the fear is they don't necessarily cover it in a really dark and sinister way. It's more of like a dark comedic way, but
yeah.
Lies can also become cancer to a certain point, right?
Mm.
Boom, mic drop.
I'm going to add a sound effect to that one.
That was perfect. I loved that.
Yeah, that was great. Cindy, sorry, will you continue? I think.
No, that was it.
Leave on a high note. No, that was great. So it does speak to the difference of perspectives. You know, Westerners typically tend to see death as an absolute end, right? And this philosophy is kind of reinforced by this idea of like carpe diem, right? We have one life. So during this one life, you want to enjoy and suck up as much joy from the teat called life as before you leave this earth. And that is kind of...
Our listeners cannot see, but Cindy and I are really making weird faces at Ray's choice of words here.
That is the literal... I think that's the literal Latin translation of carpe diem. It's suck up life's teat.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to stop you.
Carpe them diems.
That's kind of how Westerners kind of see it. But on the flip side of it, and I think about my boy Gandalf from Lord of the Rings in The Return of the King, where I think it's Mary's talking to Gandalf and he says, like, this is the end of it, isn't it? And kind of when the orcs are storming the castle. And Gandalf says...
End? No, the journey doesn't end here. Death is just another path. One that we all must take.
So it kind of poses this question is like death is just kind of a point in this greater journey that we're all in. And we see this evidenced by the grandpa scene when they're visiting the tombstone,
yes,
where they're placing fruits and snacks and burning iPhones. And this is something that, you know, my family did when my grandmother passed away. And the funny, again, another dark comedic kind of moment is like when they're discussing when Billy's dad is lighting up a cigarette. And then Nai-Nai's like, what are you doing? Like, he quit smoking. And they're like, oh, come on, let him have this cigarette. Like, he's not even here. And they're talking as if he's like right in front of them. And it's just like kind of this dark comedic moment. But this is all part of like Chinese culture where the family kind of treats the buried relative as even though their physical body has left the earth, their spirit and soul still walks this earth. And so we must treat it with respect by opening a bag of snacks for them, peeling the fruit for them, and placing it on their tombstone so they know kind of know where to go.
Very, very poignant, Ray. Hmong people are also ancestor worshipers. So we burn paper money, we burn all these different things, you know, for our relatives so that they can be able to buy passage onto like the new...
the next journey.
Yes, the ancestral realms that they will be entering in.
Yes.
And it's not just a one-time thing, actually. It's a, you know, just like how Chinese people have the grave sweeping kind of ceremonies once a year. You know, Hmong people, we don't have like a specific date per se that we are doing this, but what we do do this at any time, like maybe the anniversary of their death or things like that, where we'll go bring, just like the, in the movie, where they're bringing different types of food, drinks, you know, and then we kind of eat, in a sense, like a picnic with them. And one thing we haven't done, though, is burning paper iPhones and jackets and stuff like that. That's kind of crazy.
Well, this ancestral realm needs technology, too. They've got their own set of Apple.
That's right. My grandpa needs a yacht, so I'll make sure burn a yacht for him, too. A little tidbit about that. Lulu couldn't get the ability to actually record any other person's tombstones. And so that tombstone that you're seeing, that's actually Lulu's grandpa. And it kind of was the same thing, too. He died right after they moved from China to the United States. And so it almost felt like she was able to recreate this healing moment for herself, too. You know, and so one of the things, actually, in one of the interviews that I watched with Lulu, she goes and she says about how she didn't really get a chance to say goodbye to her grandfather. And when she takes a look at the scene where she's recording, she says she sees herself, these actors and all these different, you know, production crew all around her grandfather's gravesite. And she said it felt like this ability to kind of pay homage to him, because he always wanted to be a writer and he never had a chance to because he died fairly young.
Wow.
Yeah, I've also kind of participated in similar rituals, most recently for my grandpa who passed away about 2 years ago. But I think because we had, you know, done a lot of the gravesite visiting and burning, I think we had not just iPhones, but also like Alexis and a mansion and stuff like that. So we wanted to really set him up for the afterlife.
He really got his yacht. Nice.
Yeah.
He's probably out there. He's like, man, the afterlife is pretty sweet.
I think for me, kind of beyond the similarity and familiarity of that scene in the movie, the other thing that made me laugh a lot was when they were all bowing at various times. Because for me, one of the things I remember is, you know, each of these ceremonies that I participated in, it's obviously feels very personal because you're thinking about your relationship with someone who's no longer here, who has passed on. At the same time, I think for me, I'm also not super familiar with a lot of the rituals. So I'm kind of just going along with it as they're happening. And there's usually a lot of chanting and like more ancient sounding Chinese that I don't understand. So, you know, when they're going through and doing the bows and everyone's like out of order and then they're like, oh, we're bowing again. And I'm just like, I felt the same sort of disjointment in some of what I've experienced as well. But I think, you know, it goes back to the whole feeling of you're happy and sad, like laughing and sad at the same time.
Right.
Because I feel like that's how a lot of life's moments are experienced.
Well, one thing I found interesting that you found, Cindy, is the actual Chinese translation of the film title, which translates to "Don't tell her," right?
Yeah. So in Chinese, or the Chinese title for the film was "Bie Gao Su Ta," which means "Don't tell her." And in English, the film was called "The Farewell." I actually didn't do any research into why there was a difference, but I just thought that was interesting because they mean slightly different things,
right?
And what's funny is that, you know, Lulu's grandma is on set and she is, you know, she does know about this movie coming out. So and she knows it's about her, but she doesn't necessarily know she's the main character.
She has no idea. It's so crazy.
So then it must be hilarious for her to see, oh, why does the title say "Don't tell her"? Is it me?
Right.
They're trying not to tell.
She still doesn't know to this day.
Yeah.
Before we go into a break, I kind of want to go through one of my big takes, and I have a take here about this movie. Those who carry the most pain can often be the most wisest. And I have two cases that I can pull from this movie. I also believe that Nai Nai does know. And I think it's just a matter of mother's intuition. So in a way, they're keeping each other, the family, and Nai Nai safe from this, acknowledging this issue. And I think that it's just because they have the most perspective. And I have two people that kind of exemplify that, which is Uncle Haibin And Uncle Hyben has that moment which you talked about. Part of your favorite quote, Renee, is that he explains to Billy is that Westerners think life is about oneself, but we're all one part of a bigger picture kind of thing. You know, Billy, you are holding on to this guilt. Westerners believe that you're holding on to this guilt. And so by telling the truth, you're essentially unloading this burden of your guilt onto the other person. But what a lot of people don't realize is that now you're not taking responsibility to hold this burden, because now Nainai has to live with this acknowledgement of carrying this emotional illness on top of the illness itself. You would think that the Uncle Hyben kind of explaining that to Billy, he's the most equipped to carry this burden. I kind of thought like, okay, well, he's the most sensible one because he's able to explain this to Billy and the audience. But you see that during the wedding dinner scene, when he's giving a speech and expressing gratitude and appreciation to his mom, he's like bursting at the seams because he can't hold it all in. And so he's carrying the most pain. And while he has the most perspective, it shows that he's just carrying the most out of all the family. And another scene where I believe that Nainai does know is when Billy's about to leave and she tells Nainai that she didn't get into the fellowship. There's rare moments where bad news is actually communicated in this movie, which is, I think, is very intentional. Billy says, "I didn't want you to worry. That's why I didn't tell you." And Nainai gives this gem of saying, "Look, I've walked the path of life. You'll encounter difficulties, but you have to keep an open mind." So Nainai understands that there's hardships in life that happen and reminds Billy that it's not about what you do in life, but how you live it. And the mind is a very powerful thing. I know about my condition because at the end of the day, it got all the family to come together and we're happy and we're celebrating. It makes you ponder, is it worth it? Because they are enjoying each other. Nainai poses this idea to Billy to try to get her to understand, like, look, I know what's kind of going on. And I'd rather spend my final days preparing for a wedding versus preparing for a funeral. Yeah, and then we talk about how when Billy leaves, Nainai's like crying, she's waving. I'm like, oh, God, no.
But internally.
Internally. Yeah, exactly. I'm trying, my brain is going, I'm trying to process human emotions.
Can I go ahead and go back to that first topic about Billy's uncle? One thing that I definitely feel is that he's the oldest child, right? Even though he's only a hop, skip, and a jump away in Japan, it doesn't matter. It's still really difficult for him to be able to leave where he is to be able to come back home. He feels an immense amount of guilt about that. Yeah. He does, even though Billy's mom snipes at their cousin, right? Who's there, it has been on day-to-day basis taking care of their mom. You know, Uncle Hyben, he definitely feels he owed her a debt of gratitude because of the, you know, his lack of being there. It is immense. And he breaks down and cries and it's just like, okay, get off the stage now, but thank you.
Yeah. I was slow clap like, okay.
So it's interesting because I also see that for the eldest uncle that he feels this pressure as the eldest son. Mm-hmm. And I think in my personal experiences, I've also seen, you know, a lot of pressure being placed on eldest sons to take care of the family or deal with, organize the family around events or situations that are happening. I guess one reaction I had while I was listening to your take, Ray, was that I feel like it's almost a little bit self-imposed too, because there is society's expectation that he should be taking care of the family. And he certainly feels that. But if you think about the day-to-day, it's actually Xiao Nainai, little Nainai, and the aunt, Renee, as you mentioned, other folks who are there on the ground who are taking care of the grandmother and really shouldering the day-to-day burden. And there are parts of the movie that touch upon this a little bit, but I feel like by and large, they actually don't show the pain or any sort of burden that they carry. Outside of, I think, a few small scenes. There's one at the wedding where the mom is talking to Xiao Nainai about what she's going to do in the future. And Xiao Nainai basically reassuring her of, oh, I have this plan to travel the world and, you know, see my husband. But it focuses more on the positive than maybe the burden that she has been shouldering on a day-to-day basis.
Little tidbit about little Nainai. That's actually Lulu's little Nai-Nai. So she did such an amazing job. I don't think she actually is an actress, but she really, Lulu had said about how she really wanted her to be able to film it. And so she was really grateful that she was there to be able to kind of, you know, encapsulate this.
We're going to go ahead and take a quick break and we'll be right back. If you ever wanted to spend quality time with that special someone, just you and your partner, enjoying each other's company, cherishing every moment together, but maybe the problem is you don't know what to do, or even worse, you don't have the time to put it together. Well, let me tell you about Experiences by K. Experiences by K is a Bay Area luxury picnic business that can help bring you all the wow factor without all the wow stress. It can be set up at the beach, park, your backyard, and more. Simply go to the website, book your picnic, show up, enjoy those memorable moments. It's also great for birthdays, anniversaries, proposals, you name it. Go to experiencesbyk.com right now to make your reservation and check out Experiences by K on Instagram at Experiences by K.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods often shared with family, but don't fit a plant-based diet. The journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annie'steacakes.com to place your order today.
And now, back to the show. So I watched this clip. Lulu Wang kind of sitting at a round table with these big name directors. And she talks about how when she was making the movie or being proposed at how to distribute it, talks about the differences between having a theatrical release, also working with an independent studio versus working with like the streaming platforms. Most of the time that she says that with the streaming platforms, they often want to, because they're a brand, they often want to partner with other big name brands. But the problem is at this point, before the Farewell came out, Lulu wasn't necessarily a brand yet. So do you see kind of any difference in what your kind of reaction was with that clip that I showed you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was an interesting discussion, but to be honest, I'm not in the entertainment industry and was not really sure beyond some of the stuff that Lulu mentioned, what the trade-offs were, what the differences were between the decision she had to make.
Yeah, it's interesting because that clip shows her with just a bunch of other Hollywood directors. And so while they don't go into the specifics of the different choices of who to go with, you know, basically the idea behind it is that Netflix was actually scoping to be able to do 100% rights on the distribution for The Farewell. Mm. And that really, you know, kind of gutted Lulu. I honestly think it's because Netflix probably lowballed her that she's all like, oh, fuck no. but back in 2020, Netflix spent $17.3 billion on content alone, right? So it's a huge money-making business. And back in 2019, they spent $15 billion. So, you know, they're continuing to spend over and above for exclusive content. But one of the biggest things is that, for an example, I've only seen this happen with Amazon Prime, actually, where Amazon also has a distribution arm to go into the actual theaters, while Netflix has not done that. And one of the biggest controversies is, should a digital streamed movies and content be eligible for awards? I think at that point it was too new for Lulu, and she definitely, that was really important for her. She's still up and coming. She doesn't really have a brand. And so, you know, that was basically what you can be able to see is just this hesitancy being only exclusive to Netflix, because one of the biggest things is Netflix doesn't have deep enough penetration to the Chinese market.
Okay, let me play another clip for y'all.
I'm curious, when you brought the idea of this film to sort of Hollywood financiers, how they reacted to it?
Oh, they were like, take all the money. Think about your Chinese grandmother, right. Subtitled, yeah. All Asian cast. Yeah. Where's my checkbook? No, that's not really how it went.
They were interested, at least, yes?
They were interested in the premise. You know, they felt like, oh, this ruse, this facade, it's kind of screwball. Let's take that and let's run with it. Let's go more screwball. Let's go broader. Let's make this my big fat Chinese wedding.
But let's put a white character in? They wanted a white character in?
That was actually a Chinese investor. He said, you know, if we're going to bring this film to Chinese audiences, the thing that's going to be entertaining for them to watch is somebody who's American. I said, well, Billy's American. He said, no, like a real American.
A real American.
Right, exactly. Like a white guy that she brings home, doesn't understand the culture, and we'll all laugh at the fact that he can't use chopsticks. It's like, that's not the story.
Damn.
I know. So one thing that really stood out to me was interesting is it was actually a Chinese financier who wanted to whitewash the film. But also the second point of it is how producers kind of envisioned her story to be like, oh, this premise is kind of screwball. Let's turn it into a screwball film. And I immediately kind of thought with Adam Sandler's Just Go With It, which is his kind of similar premise where he starts off with a lie and he has to continue to lie to kind of keep up with the original lie. I am so glad that Lulu basically said, no, I have a very specific vision about this movie and how I want to portray it.
So I definitely want to go ahead and note that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, while it amassed a $213.5 million worldwide box office, in the U.S. alone, it did $128 million, right? There is a precedent for being able to have smash box office hits that are 100% not in English and subtitles, right? But I understand that maybe it's because it was more action-driven, things like that, that's why Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon had that success, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in the later episode. But, you know, one of the things is that it is something that is such a huge hurdle to be able to have to, you know, climb over, if you will, of being able to find people who are willing to tell Asian-American and American stories, right? Because the thing is that Zhao Xuchen says this story is not unique in China, but told from an American's perspective, it absolutely is an American tale of how we're stuck saddled between East meets West, right? So, you know, I think one of the things that I'm hopeful is that as we continue to have these Asian American stories, that we can continue to have this landscape where we can pretty much be anything. We can not only be crazy rich, but we can also be crazy broke, and we can be able to have these three-dimensional characters that doesn't just have to be smart overachievers like Better Luck Tomorrow, but also being able to have these subtle, nuanced characters where we're not just the slapstick sidekick or just the comedic relief.
You know, Ray, my reaction to that clip, I feel like especially the discussion around adding a character from a Chinese perspective who goes to China and is trying to learn about the traditions, it almost feels like, you know, it's different cultures trying to impose their versions of what they think will be interesting or what they want to see versus,
right,
to Renee's point, kind of this intersection of East meets West and a lot of the complexities that come out of it, which may be different, untraditional from what, you know, folks in the U.S. or folks in China are used to seeing. So I think that was one thing that I thought about listening to the clip. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, to the point of, you know, just tossing a white guy in there who's a love interest is, you know, there's this movie test that a lot of films will be put against called the Bechdel test. I don't know if you all have talked about this on the podcast before, but the premise is basically, to pass this test, the movie has to have at least two named women in it who talk to each other about something besides a man. And the point is basically that I think in a lot of films, it becomes a distractor that, you know, you just put in some sort of love interest and then the women spend a good amount of time or some amount of time discussing it versus focusing on other topics. And I feel like, you know, for this example, it would have been a huge distractor and really would have taken away from the most important parts of what Lulu wanted to show and to really focus on Awkwafina and her journey and experience.
Right. And the love interest is actually between her cousin, Hao Hao and his 3 months dating Aiko, right?
Yeah, I think my major props for her for keeping up with this whole thing with this family that she doesn't know. She deserves a lot more credit. She's just standing there like.
Do you think they were, that was like his actual girlfriend, or they didn't just like find some person that
just
go along with it
for
this wedding and like.
Possibly.
It's actually really funny because a little tidbit about Aiko, the actual actress, Aoi Mizuhara, she is fluent in Chinese and Japanese. She actually, so while she was born in Japan and is Japanese, she actually is nationally Chinese. And she was saying one thing is that she kind of was kind of remiss about her role was that when she looked back at watched the film, she said she felt really stiff and she kind of was upset about that because when she actually watched the wedding video of Aiko, she saw how head over heels in love and starry-eyed and lovey-dovey she was to Hao Hao. And so she wished she could have been able to redo that again as opposed to being like this restrained and kind of clunky person.
So this movie was pretty successful when it was released. Well-received, critically acclaimed. However, the Golden Globes nominated for Best Foreign Picture, even though it's an American film, and that is because it's like 80% in Mandarin. Can we just say that the Hollywood foreign press is racist?
Super. God damn.
These rules are so arbitrary.
They just do it over and over and over again. And it's really fucked up, right? Like, I try not to cuss that much on the podcast, but I got to say it.
Beep.
It's absolutely fucked up that they did that because we are Americans, right? We need to be, and that's why it matters. Representation matters because we need to be able to create that language and that landscape of what American means, what Asian means, and what Asian American means, right? I think we all can be able to say, like, we've all struggled with being able to be enough of one or the other or both, right? And, you know, that's not necessarily a just our own story. I think everyone, has trouble with their own identity. And so, you know, I really, really hope, you know, petition to the Golden Globes, please stop fucking it up.
Yeah, I think, you know, Ray, one of the comments you had added was around the requirement of at least 50% or more English dialogue in order to be eligible to be, I guess, domestic US film. And I think part of it, to Renee, your point, is that we need to expand our definition. I don't know why we haven't.
Right.
Because we're basically a land of immigrants of what constitutes quote unquote American, right? If we're a land of immigrants, mm-hmm. we come with all of our different cultures and languages, and why would that not be perceived as American?
And obviously, and this is said over and over again, but I think it's also it's important to continuously say it over and over again. The foreign part of it perpetuates the otherism part of it, right?
Absolutely.
And we see it happening recently. You know, you'd figured by this time the backlash that the Golden Globes got from this movie, they would learn, but they literally did the same thing with Minari, where Minari is an American film that's set in America. So
exactly.
That's unbelievable.
Oh my God. In middle America. It's a landlocked portion of America, right? And so
I don't know how American you can get.
Right. And so, you know, Golden Globes gave this award of Best Motion Picture to this movie called Babel back in 2007. It's director Alejandro González Iñárritu. Isn't white, right? And most of it's actually either in Japanese sign language, Spanish, or, you know, all these other different languages other than just English, right? But oh no, it has Brad Pitt in it, right? It has we gotta go ahead and give it to them.
So let me ask you a question then. While these stories are important in these movies, I feel like in a way we don't need the validation from the Golden Globes, right? But at the same time, do you feel like we do need that validation from the Golden Globes? Like where do you lie in terms of like, it's like, how dare you? But that's not to prevent us from telling good stories, but how dare you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a conflicted perspective. Because on one hand, I think part of it is just throwing out the rule book or rewriting the rules or making your own rules. But at the same time, for those who see the Golden Globes and other more mainstream recognition as something that they need to also recognize you, it's like this double-edged sword of also needing or wanting that to feel like you have your place in society.
Mm. Going piggybacking off of what Cindy was saying about awards, they have this thing called the EGOT, right?
Oh, yeah.
EGOT.
E, Emmy, G, Grammy, Academy, Arts,
Oscar, and then Tony.
Oscars. Yes, Tony, right? Sorry. Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah, so there's the EGOT, right? And so there's, yeah, you can be able to just splice that up. Yeah. Anyway. Yes. So your Emmy, Grammy, Oscars, and Tony. And, you know, there is even a list of people who basically aspire to be, to have an EGOT. And so does it validate? I don't know. I mean, like, we kind of pat ourselves on the back about being able to get first, second, third place, right? Being the best, being on top, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do we need more Asian people who have EGOTs? Maybe, right? I think Philip Lassie was probably close up there, almost. And so there you go. Yes, I know Ray's favorite.
Last topic we'll go over. Lulu Wang has a very simple solution for Hollywood diversity and inclusion problem. And that is just give them the damn job. What she's noticing, that some diversity programs are about empowering women and people of color, but kind of teaching them in a way to speak the language of the white man, speak the language of the white executive to be able to gain opportunity. But it's also kind of saying in a way, it's an opportunity to even just have opportunity. And what Lulu says is that it's a little condescending. Just give them the damn job and they'll be able to handle the rest. So Cindy and Renee, do you see that it's a little problematic that these diversity programs are not necessarily accomplishing what they're set out to?
So, you know, I work in the entertainment industry, on the video game industry side, and it is a very white male dominated industry in the US. It's a little bit different in Asia, for example, which actually has quite a bit of success there too, but a lot of it is because they aspire to be able to penetrate the U.S. market. Sorry, Ray. I'm never going to be able to say that word ever again. Penetrate. Okay, but you know, basically the whole idea behind it is that, you know, who's the ones who are telling the stories? Well, there's all these games that are being made that try to cater to, yes, your Asian audience, but a lot of times they're trying to cater to an American audience because we spend the most money, right? You know, the whole idea of like this diversity and inclusion, you know, I'm kind of moving away from those terms and being more about compassion and empathy. And the idea is that instead of making it so that it's you're the token Asian in the room, which happens, you're being hired for your qualities. That what some people have done is actually removed names from resumes so that you're actually just looking at the person's merits. And so, you know, some of the things too that the people are starting to kind of take away as well, and not necessarily take away, but just like obfuscate, is also like the education. Where did they come from? Because that also, you know, just because you went to an Ivy League school doesn't mean that you're more worthy or less worthy than someone because of, for whatever reason, your dad had a lot more money. So, you know, it's a very controversial thing, absolutely, about whether or not it works or it doesn't. But, you know, I can be able to talk about it from that perspective where, you know, there's also like the tech industry, the same thing too. It's normally a 30-70% split of male to female ratio. You take into account that these industries are still fairly young, right? And still constantly evolving. And you have these gatekeepers like Harvey Weinstein, who people have to suck up to and kiss up to, and sometimes literally, right? So
that bag of grossness.
So that's what I'm trying to get at, is that we need more executives of color that aren't going to, you know, a fucking actress on, you know, the couch casting call, right? Like, I hate that fucking shit. And so, like, I'm really passionate about this. Sorry, I just like talking up like a sailor here. But, you know, like, that's the thing, is like, we need more people like Lulu. We need more people like, you know, Alice Wu, who are wonderful directors who can be able to be empowered to become a powerful executives, so that they can be able to, you know, continue to put forth and empower another generation of directors and storytellers who can be able to feel like they can tell their story without the guise of a white lens that we have to, you know, cater to.
So similar to what Renee mentioned, when I think about filmmaking, mostly from an audience, so consumer perspective, to me, it feels like there is some science involved, but it's mostly art. And from that perspective, it's super subjective and should be really focused on telling more diverse stories. Whereas today, like Renee mentioned, there's, you know, arbitrary gatekeepers that will decide which stories have more merit or will be more interesting for their audiences. And certainly to a you know, certain extent, we think about it from a monetary perspective of what will make the most money too. But, you know, further, even beyond that, it's not just about what will make money today, but, you know, what's going to make money in the future? How are we changing as a, you know, a globalized society too, in terms of the stories that will resonate and be recognized as we move forward?
And it's simply just about taking a chance, not thinking too much into it. If someone has a good story, it doesn't matter who they are, where they come from, just give them the damn job.
Yes.
Alrighty. Well, this is going to conclude this episode. I want to thank Cindy and Renee again. And to all the listeners, farewell.
Thanks, everyone. That was a good one.
Thank you. Okay, bye. Hey, Real Asian listeners, it's Ray. I appreciate your support by listening to our podcast. You know, there's a lot of effort and preparation that goes into the show so that we can talk about why these films may be important to us as Asian Americans. And hopefully you share some of our feelings too. We'd appreciate it if you could support our show by becoming a patron. By becoming a patron, you'll help cover some of the production costs that help us record virtually and release onto your favorite podcast app. Only if you're in a position to support us, go to realasianpodcast.com/support and become a patron today.